It's human nature to wonder what lies behind a closed door. Nothing has the power to intrigue us like a thing that's hidden, far away, or lost to time. But sometimes, things are closer than they appear. Today, we're discussing real stories of remote viewing. Welcome to Shadowland, everybody.
Welcome.
This is a podcast that shines a spotlight on stories of the supernatural, mysterious, eerie, and unexplained. Stuff like NDEs.
Ancient giants.
Guardian angels.
Abominable snowman.
Miracles.
MK Ultra.
Ghost cars.
Men in black.
Poltergeists.
Golems.
Zombies.
Probes.
Urban legends.
Human pig hybrids.
Past lives.
Holographic universe theory. I feel like I'm gonna have to like do that one sooner than later. I keep teasing
human pig hybrids. All of that stuff. But especially human pig hybrids.
Yes. And so I'm Seth Jablon.
I'm Christina Callery.
And today, what are we talking about?
Today, we're talking about remote viewing.
Yes, I'm really excited about this.
Waiting for this one.
I'm actually really excited about this. I like had a
super excited. You're so excited, you forgot.
Yes. Well, I had like I had a sense of what I wanted to. When we've been talking about this one pretty much since the beginning, and I had a sense of, I think I'd read some books when I was like a teenager about this. I was all into like astral projection and stuff.
Oh my god, that's what we got to do next then.
Yeah.
Did you read Robert Monroe's astral projection?
Oh, I don't remember. Okay. I don't remember the
name. I read that when I was in college.
So I had an idea about what this was about, but but the story I found like totally blew my mind, so I'm like super excited about it. Before we get into it though, I don't know, like I know we do news sometimes, but did we talk about this? Did you see that the Pentagon recently released those released those UFO videos and like basically copped to the fact that they track UFOs, that UFOs are real? And did you see that?
This isn't what came out about 6 months ago, is it brand
yeah
new?
So basically it all comes from the videos that were leaked by the guy from Blink-182. What's his name? Tom is it Tom DeLong or something like that?
I was never a fan, but
right, that guy, the guy, he started like his own private disclosure project, and yeah, and so he released those videos, and then like a year later the Navy or Air Force were like, yeah, they're real. And then the Pentagon, like a week or two ago, was like, yeah, those are real. And like re-released them as like, yep, there's UFOs. But I just thought it was funny that they did that during, you know, the sort of pandemic. either they were just like sitting around bored or something, you know, like, or they're like, this is a good time to do this. Like, no one will notice, but.
Strategic, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Anyways, I just thought that was interesting. All right, well, let's get into it then.
Do you want to go first?
Yes, I do. So okay. So we talked about this a little bit. Like, I'm going to touch a little bit on sort of one of the central subjects when you're talking about remote viewing. It's hard not to talk about Project Stargate, which is sort of the government's scientific experiment project or whatever, where they studied.
That lasted decades.
Yeah. And it's sort of hard to talk about remote viewing without talking about that because, I mean, I guess, you know, just taking a step back, like, I'm not sure what the difference is between what people would call astral projection and remote viewing. But I think remote viewing is generally the term that's used when you're talking about these specific types of experiments, right? It was like intelligent community trying to use them tactically, right?
Right. Yeah. And I mean, obviously it's been around you know, as long as humankind has.
Right.
Clairvoyance, which means clear seeing. So it wasn't invented by these people, but it was heavily researched in a really methodical way for a number of years.
Right, with the goal of using it for intelligence operations, right?
Yes, ideally. Yeah, like locate underground bases and...
Right. Which is ultimately why they shut down the project, right? So it went on for decades, but eventually they closed it because they said they couldn't reliably use it for intelligence gathering. Although there were some instances of, you know, proven remote seeing, which I'll get into. I'll touch on a couple of those.
Did you actually go to the CIA's site?
I did, yes.
Isn't that crazy?
Yes, it is crazy. Okay, so let me start at the beginning here. Okay. So I got a whole bunch that I wrote for this. So actually from Wikipedia. So Wikipedia defines remote seeing as the practice of seeking impressions about a distant or unseen target, purportedly using extrasensory perception, ESP, or sensing with the mind, right? So that's what Wikipedia says. I think there's certainly some connection to astral projection, you know, which is a lot of people, others either consider it synonymous with it or, you know, at least connected to it, right? And for those who don't know what astral projection is, I can't imagine that most of our listeners don't know, but it's basically when you travel outside of the physical body using the astral body or the consciousness, right? So... but when we're talking about remote viewing, like I was just saying, there's usually like an intentional effort there in a controlled environment, in an experiment or military investigation where the subject is expected to give information about an object, an event, a person, or a location that's sort of hidden from physical view, right? Or separated at some distance. So they started, I don't know what the original origin of the Stargate project was. Like, I don't know if it like came out of, you know, MK Ultra, or like there was a bunch of that stuff going on around the time when this thing was started, right? So another Wikipedia entry, Stargate project worked primarily involved in remote viewing the purported ability to physically see events, sites, or other information from a great distance. And the project was overseen until 1987 by Lieutenant Frederick Holmes Skip Atwater, an aide and psychic hunter to Major General Albert Steubelbein, I don't know how to say his name, and later president of the Monroe Institute.
So the unit was small. Such a great job title.
Yeah, right. The unit was small scale, and it was comprised of about 15 to 20 individuals. And it was run out of an old leaky wooden barracks, right? All the descriptions of this place is it's pretty like shabby.
But it was a bunch of scientists, you know?
Yeah, it was right, a bunch of scientists.
It was like, you know, data analysts and physicists and, you know, it wasn't.
Yes, and they definitely had
people. Yeah, it was.
Right. It wasn't woo-woo people. It was definitely when you hear the transcript, like they definitely had a methodology to the way they did this. You know, they approached it like a, you know, military or scientific operation. Like it was pretty, buttoned up in that sense. It was just that, you know, in terms of their facilities, they were working out of this sort of old place. After the... From a document on Stargate, which is available on the CIA site, the program sought to cultivate psychoenergetics, which defines a mental process by which an individual perceives, communicates with, and or perturbs characteristics of a designated target, person, or event remote in space and or time from that individual. In particular, Stargate focused on remote viewing. Which involves, you know, basically traveling with the mind to some destination. And they have a whole like sort of methodology of how they did that. And the CIA or whoever was running this program proposes that remote viewing is actually inherent to every human in some degree and is probably a vestigial form of self-preservation, right? Like you were kind of saying before, like, you know, maybe back on the like African savanna, you know, like the ability to like sense, you know, or see like a herd off in the distance or enemies coming, you know what I mean? Like, so, okay. So yeah, like I said before, the project was ultimately terminated and declassified in 1995 after the CIA determined it wouldn't be useful in intelligence operations. And the program was also depicted in pop culture with the book and film title, The Men Who Stare at Goats. So that was largely
about I never saw that. Did you see it?
I did. It wasn't super good. I mean, I think, what's his name was in it? I can't remember now. It was like, it was okay. Like, I think I read the book and the book, you know, was maybe a little better and they tried to make it a little bit more comedic.
You kind of have to with that title.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they really did, for those who don't know, again, like they really did try to stare at goats until they died. They would try to stop their hearts with their minds. And I can't remember if anyone ever did that or purported to have ever done it, but that was definitely a thing that they tried to do.
It's sad. I mean, why can't you stare at goats until they're, you know, like amazingly happy or something?
I don't know. I think it had something to do with the fact that there were like goats around again, like this place, like, you know, their whole setup. I don't know. Like there was something about the fact that the goats there wasn't like, oh, we've got the perfect subject. They just happened to have like goats around. So they're like, I don't know. So they became a target. But okay. So although they ultimately did determine it couldn't be reliably used for intelligence operations, they did have some results that ended up in the paper. One in particular, one subject was able to pinpoint the location of a unknown Soviet submarine that was later verified with satellite imagery. So they did have some results that, like, you know, these things could be done. And I think there was a lot of experiments, but I think ultimately they determined they just couldn't rely on it. So something to it, but not necessarily like they just,
or at least that was the official word,
or that was the official word, right? We don't know. Okay, so after they declassified everything, they eventually did a document dump on the CIA's website. So amongst those documents is a transcript of a session, which I'm going to go super deep into here in a second. So basically, this is the story of the time a CIA operative astral projected to Mars.
Okay. Oh my God. So okay. Oh, okay.
For a moment. I don't know if you've heard of this yet, but okay. So, I'm basically going to read the transcript. All right. Cause I just think it's going to have a different impact if I do that. Like it's pretty great. It's very eerie. There's definitely something to it. And it just gives you a sense of, you know, how they ran these sessions, and it also like kind of takes you there. So basically what they would do is they would hand the subject a sealed envelope right before the interview containing the point of interest. And it wasn't opened until after the interview. Right. So basically they hand this person, the subject, an envelope that contains a 3x5 card. And on that card says the planet of Mars, time of interest, approximately 1 million years BC. Okay. So that's what's written on the card and sort of handed to this guy. The guy basically takes it, doesn't open it. And then that subject is given.
Was that really the time frame that far back?
Yeah. What I read is literally what was on the card. 1 million years BC. So then they give the guy coordinates. So I'll get into it later, but he basically thinks he's looking around Earth, right? He doesn't really understand what he's looking at most of the time. Okay. So I'm going to read the transcript now.
What's the name of the guy?
And well, I'll get to that, but in the transcript, it's, I'm going to say monitor and subject, right?
Okay. All right.
The monitor remains unnamed and anonymous. Okay. Monitor. All right, now, using the information in the envelope I've provided, exclusively focusing your attention now, using the information in the envelope, focus on 40 degrees north, 9.55 degrees west. Subject. I want to say it looks like, I kind of got an oblique view of it. A pyramid form. It's very high. It's kind of sitting in a large depressed area. Monitor. All right. Subject. It's yellowish, an ochre colored. Monitor. All right. Move in time to the time indicated in the envelope I provided you and describe what's happening. Subject. I'm tracking severe clouds, more like dust storm. It's like a geologic problem. Seems to be like just a minute. I've got to iron this out. It's really weird. Monitor. Just report your raw perceptions at this time. You're still early on in the session. Subject. I'm looking at a after effect of a major geologic problem. Monitor. Okay, go back to the time before the geologic problem. Subject. Total difference. It's before there's no, I don't know. Hell, it's like mountains of dirt appear and then disappear when you go before. See large flat surfaces, very smooth angles, walls. They're all really large though. I mean, they're megalithic. Monitor. All right. At this period in time, now before the geologic activity, look around in and around this area and see if you can find any activity. Subject. I'm seeing it's like a perception of a shadow people. Very tall, thin. It's only a shadow. It's as if they were there and now they're not. Not there anymore. Monitor. Go back to a period of time where they are there. Subject. It's like I get a lot of static on a line and everything, it's all breaking up. Very fragmentary pieces. Monitor, just report the raw data. Don't try to put things together. Just report the raw data. Subject, I just keep seeing very large people. They appear thin and tall, but they're very large, wearing some kind of strange clothes. Monitor, all right, now holding in this time period, I want you to move from your physical location in space to another physical location, but in this time period. Move now to 46.5 north, 353.22 east. Subject, deep inside a cavern, or it's not a cavern, more like a canyon. I'm seeing up the sides of a steep wall that seemed to go on forever. And there's like a structure with it's like the wall of a canyon that's been carved. Again, I'm getting a very large structure, no intricacies, huge sections of smooth stone. Monitor, do the structure have insides and outsides? Subject, yes, it's like a rabbit warren. Corners of rooms, they're really huge. I don't feel like I'm standing in one. It's just really huge. Perception is the ceiling is very high, walls very wide. Monitor, yes, that would be correct. All right, I'd like to move now to another location nearby. All right, move from this point in time to, and at this point, the monitor asks him to move again, which he keeps doing as he's like trying to find something basically. So he's asking him to move to nearby areas, then other areas. So for the sake of time, I'm just going to omit the monitor telling him to move around. I'm just going to read the descriptions of what he sees. Subject, they have it appears to be the end of a very large road, and there's a marker thing that's very large. Keep getting Washington Monument overlay. It's like an obelisk. He moves again. It's like I'm in the middle of a huge circular basin of the range of mountains by almost all the way around. Very ragged mountains, very tall. Basin's very, very, very large. Scale seems to be off or something. It's just really big. Everything's big. Just see a right angle to something, but that's all. I don't see anything else. He moves again. The clusters of squares up and down, it's like you want to make them square in a way. They're almost flush with the ground, and it's like they're all connected. Something very white reflects light. He moves again. It's like I can just perceive like a radiating pattern of some kind. It's like some strange intersecting roads that are dug into valleys, you know, where a road is just a little below the edge. Monitor, tell me about the shapes of these things. Subject, they're like real neat channel cut. They're very deep. It's like the road went down. So at this point, like the monitor, like it almost sounds like he's getting frustrated because he keeps like, you know, emphatically saying that everything's so huge and deep. And the guy's like, yeah, I get it. But basically at this point, the monitor says he's noticing the subjects having trouble staying focused. He keeps saying he's like electrically nulled out or whatever. So obviously they're like monitoring this guy somehow. I don't know how, but so he keeps moving him around and the subject just keeps seeing these pyramids. So the monitor actually notes parenthetically, I think that he's losing his ability to move accurately, but he is attracted to things that are interesting. So we're going to go with his own. We're going to let him go ahead and explore what seems to be interesting to him rather than move on the targets indicated here. So, and I think in a few of these places, like 30 minutes goes by, right? Where he's like moving around and before he sort of reports back. Okay, so monitor. Okay, do these pyramids have insides and outsides? Subject, it's filtered from storms or something. Monitor, say that again. Subject, they're like shelters from storms. Monitor, these structures you're seeing? Subject, yes, they're designed for that. Monitor, all right, go inside one of these and find some activity to tell me about. So here it's plus 37 minutes real time. So like he just goes silent, I imagine, for like 30 minutes, like exploring this, whatever he's seeing. Okay, subject, different chambers, but they're almost stripped of any kind of furnishings or anything. It's like a strictly functional place for sleeping. That's not a good word. Hibernation, some form. I can't get real raw. I get real raw input. Storms, savage storms, and sleeping through storms. Monitor, tell me about the ones who sleep through the storms. Subject, very tall again, very large people. Both, they're thin. They look thin because of their height, and they dress like, oh hell, it's like real light silk, but it's not the flowing type of clothing. It's like cut to fit. Monitor, move close to one of them and ask them to tell you about themselves. Subject, they're ancient people. They're dying. It's past their time or age. Monitor, tell me about this. Subject, they're very philosophic about it. They're looking for a way to survive and they just can't. Monitor, plus 40 minutes, definite voltage reversal, which I don't know what that means. Subject, can't seem to get their way out. They can't seem to find their way out. So they're hanging on while they just look or wait for something to return or something coming with the answer. Monitor, what is it that they're waiting for? Subject, there was a group or a party of them that went to find a new place to live. It's like I'm getting all kinds of overwhelming input of the corruption of their environment. It's failing very rapidly, and this group went somewhere like a long way away to find another place to live. Monitor, what was the cause of the atmospheric disturbance or the environmental disturbance? Subject, I see a picture of it's almost like a warp in, oh God, this is difficult. Monitor, the raw data. Subject, oh, I get a globe. It's like a globe that goes through a comet's tail or it's through a river of something, but it's all very cosmic. It's like space pictures. Monitor, all right. Now, before you leave this individual, ask him if there's any way that you, ask him if he knows any who you are and if there's any way you can help him in his present predicament. Subject, all I get is that they must wait. Doesn't know who I am, thinks he perceives I'm a hallucination or something. Monitor, okay, when the others left, these people are waiting. When the others left, how did they go? Subject, get an impression of, don't know what the hell it is. Looks like the inside of a larger boat. Very rounded walls and shiny metal. Monitor, go along with them on their journey and find out where they go. Subject, impression of a really crazy place with volcanoes and gas pockets and strange planets. Very volatile place. It's much like going from the frying pan into the fire. Difference there is that it seems to be a lot of vegetation, whereas the other place didn't have it. And different kind of storms. Monitor, all right, it's time to come back now to the sound of my voice, into the present time, to right now, 22nd of May, 1984, the sound of my voice. Move now back to the room, back to the sound of my voice, back further now to the sound of my voice on the 22nd of May, 1984. That's the end of the interview. Isn't that fucking crazy?
Whoa.
Like, wow. Dude, that is insane. So, yeah. I mean, just like going there with him is bananas. Like, you're like, again, I just, you know, this guy, we're going to get into it in a second, but he didn't know what he was looking at, right? He didn't know what was in the envelope. And just, okay, well, all right, let me keep going here. So, okay, so Slate actually did an article on this. And through some investigating, they found out who made the recording or who was the subject in that transcript. So it was the writer, the writer Jacob Brogan from Slate found him through a couple books he had written, namely The Stargate Chronicles and Mind Trek, which contains an account largely in line with this transcript. And so his name is Joseph McMonagall. And he was the same man who actually saw the submarine that I mentioned earlier, right? So we know this.
Yeah. Isn't he supposed to be one of the top psychics, like one of the best performers of the whole Stargate project?
Yes. I mean, I didn't go super deep into the whole Stargate project thing, but he definitely has, like, he's definitely one of the top guys. And, some of his stuff has been proven in a big way, right? That submarine was like big enough to make the news and all that. So Brogan reaches out to him and, talks to him about this. And McMonagall tells Brogan they shouldn't have had that, right? And he said that the session had not actually been requested by the CIA, but by an individual from the Army. So he said at the time he was staying at the Virginia-based Monroe Institute, which I described earlier. And he said that he was napping in a black box, which was a shielded containment room with 1 foot thick walls. I don't know why he was being shielded, but he said he was awakened by the Institute's director and the unnamed monitor, and they handed him the sealed envelope before leading him through the session. So as far as he knew, he was looking for targets on Earth, and he was actually confused about what he was seeing. And he said, to quote, I was not familiar with any Pomerans on Earth that had such large rooms. So that's why he was sort of confused the whole time about like how big these structures were. So that is the story of the time the CIA operative actually projected him to Mars. Isn't that crazy, dude?
That is crazy. And I don't know. I was very taken with that. I didn't realize there was someone else who was a psychic astronaut because I did one too.
Oh, you did? Yes.
I did.
Oh, great. Synchronicity, right? Synchronicity. But I just like, all right, we'll get into it in a second, but after your story, but I just love this idea of this guy going 1 million years into the past. And the other part
that is fascinating because I mean, that's another thing that happened in these experiments. And there were other ones that they did where people even inadvertently saw back in time.
Right, right.
So it's something, yeah.
And they had all these coordinates, which is also very interesting. Like, where'd they get these coordinates? Why are they having him look at these? And there's even one part where he starts describing what he's seeing at the coordinate, and the monitor's like, yes, that's right. That's correct. So clearly they were looking for something, right?
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. Do you want to do any of yours? Yeah,
I'll do mine. So the person that I'm doing, I actually have two stories.
Okay,
but,
cool.
But the first one is someone who was involved with the Stargate project and was basically like a founder of all of it, one of the founders. So this initial testing was done at the Stanford Research Institute, otherwise known as SRI. And that's where a lot of these experiments were conducted over two decades. But one of the main people involved was named Ingo Swann. He was one of the co-creators. Yes. Yeah. So along with Russell Targ, who I'm going to close with a tip from him on how to remote view if you want to try it.
Oh, really?
It.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah. And Harold Puthoff? I don't know. That's what it looks like. And among other people. But so Ingo Swann, who has the perfect name for this, in my opinion. He was an artist. He did mostly oil paintings. He lived in New York City most of his life. And his work tended to focus on the metaphysical stuff that he experienced. He pretty much devoted his life to this stuff. And his work evolved with him over the years, depending on what he was experiencing at the time. And by all accounts, he reportedly possessed considerable psychic abilities that were proven out in experiments, including the Stargate Project. So he wasn't just a subject, though. He was a lifelong researcher into the field of parapsychology, and he really helped to shape the study of remote viewing. So in addition to taking part in the research, he authored like a dozen books. And this is according to his website. He, quote, viewed psi powers as only parts of the larger spectrum of human sensing systems.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's just part of the broader whole. And I think a lot of the people involved in this, including Russell Targ, who I mentioned earlier, kind of look at remote viewing is just something that's innate to humans. It's not magical. It's not something that only a special few can do. It's something that's just part of our abilities. For whatever reason, we're not in touch with that necessarily, but there are ways that we can learn to be in touch with it. So Ingo Swann was born in Telluride in 1933, and apparently he had psychic abilities that were evident when he was a child. So it was something that early on started to kind of be part of his whole life and draw his attention. He went to college in Utah, Westminster College, where he earned a double bachelor's degree in art and biology. So even back then, he had this kind of dual thing happening where he was an artist, but he was also a scientist at heart. And then after graduating, he joined the Army for 15 years. But his work in parapsychology began when he was 36 years old, around 1969. And at this time, he was living in New York, and he started out working with paranormal researchers there. And the early research involved the influence of mental abilities on plants. That was one of the experiments. And also psychokinetic abilities and temperature control.
What? All right.
Yeah. So apparently he, you know, was in touch with these people who were studying this stuff. And because of his abilities, he took part in these experiments. But then starting in 1972, this is when he began working at the Stanford Research Institute, where he eventually caught the attention of the CIA and became part of the Stargate Project. So he, like all told, he worked from 1972 through 1988 at SRI. You know, he was interviewed and profiled by numerous media outlets throughout the years. Some of them called him the scientific psychic because of his research-based approach. And if you remember Yuri Geller, we mentioned him in the John Lennon alien story.
Yes.
So Geller was also a fan of Swann and his work. Okay. So for his very first experiment at SRI, researchers concealed a magnetic field known as a Josephson, I guess. I don't know. But anyway, this was placed inside a device used to detect subatomic particles. And the whole device was hidden about, like, beneath 5 feet of concrete. And Swann was able to visualize this highly complicated apparatus. And the results were so impressive that they were later reported at a conference on parapsychology and quantum physics. Okay, but soon after that, his experiments were literally out of this world.
Couldn't resist.
I couldn't resist. He became a psychic astronaut. So, okay,
I didn't even know that was like a thing before this. Like
me neither. I mean, but it makes total sense because it's like, okay, do you really, if you have this ability, do you really want to just like, you know, want to go find like,
no,
you
totally.
Know, where people have underground bases or something? Like totally, you want to go to space, right? Okay.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah.
Okay. So, in April of 1973, Swan had grown a little bored with his usual targets, and he was very successful. He was one of the top people that made a lot of what they called hits, which were basically like when they were doing these experiments, they would give people coordinates, and if the description or drawing or whatever bore a lot of resemblance to what it was that they were trying to find, then it was considered a hit. But gotcha. By 1973, Swan was kind of already getting a little bored with this. So he decided to do a remote viewing session on the planet Jupiter, which in 1973, we really didn't know too much about. And this was not funded by the CIA, but it actually is in their documents that's posted on the CIA website if anybody wants to go look at it. So he was kind of like the Elon Musk of remote space travel.
Okay. Yeah, and like Jupiter, I feel like there was a lot like the 70s and like 2001 was sort of oriented around Jupiter and Europa and like the idea that there was this ice moon that might have liquid water and stuff was very intriguing to everyone. So yeah.
Okay. So, but all of this happened before Voyager 1 helped us learn more about the gas giant. So Voyager didn't actually tour Jupiter until 1979, 6 years later. So Swan planned an experiment with another psychic and his name was Harold Sherman. And the plan was for the two men to take a remote voyage to Jupiter and then compare notes. Because soon after that, the Pioneer 10 probe was supposed to capture some data. And this is like, you know, early initial data about the planet, you know, back in 1973. So they were going to, but that wasn't scheduled to happen until November or December. And they were doing this in April beforehand. So liftoff for them occurred on April 27th, 1973 at 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Swan was conducting his session from California and Sherman was in Arkansas. So the two of them were not communicating in any way during this. They were separated. They were both apparently placed in sensory deprivation tanks so they could just hone in on their target and, you know, black out everything else. And so I'll read some transcripts from specifically Swan experienced. So the first report came at 6:03 p.m. So it took him 3 minutes to travel to Jupiter. And he starts by saying there's a planet with stripes. And then he says, I think that it must have an extremely large hydrogen mantle. If a space probe made contact with that, it would be maybe 80,000 to 120,000 miles out from the planet's surface. So he gets really specific. And then at 6:06, he says, very high in the atmosphere, there are crystals. They glitter. Maybe the stripes are like bands of crystals. Maybe like rings of Saturn, though not far out like that, very close within the atmosphere. And very interesting side note, 6 years later, Voyager 1 would confirm that Jupiter did in fact have rings, but at this point they hadn't been observed.
Oh, that's what he's talking about, the crystals?
Seeing rings like Saturn before there's been confirmation scientifically.
Okay, I didn't know.
Jupiter. So nobody knew at this point that
Jupiter has rings.
Had rings.
I didn't really know that. Yeah.
Yeah. it has rings. Okay. So 6:08. He says, "Now I'll go down through. It feels really good there." And then he laughs and he says, "Inside those cloud layers, those crystal layers, they look beautiful from the outside. From the inside, they look like rolling gas clouds, eerie yellow light like rainbows." And then he says, I get the impression, though I don't see, that it's liquid. And then at 6:10, he says, "Then I came through the cloud cover. The surface, it looks like sand dunes. They're made of very large grade crystals, so they slide. Tremendous winds, sort of like maybe the prevailing winds of Earth, but very close to the surface of Jupiter. From that view, the horizon looks orangish or rose-colored, but overhead it's kind of greenish-yellow. If I look to the right, there's an enormous mountain range." And then at 6:18, he says, "I see something that looks like a tornado. Is there a thermal inversion here? I bet there is. I bet you that the surface of Jupiter will give a very high infrared count rating." And then he says, "I seem to be stuck, not moving. I'll move towards the equator. I get the impression that it must be a band of crystals similar to the outer ones, kind of bluish. They seem to be a sort of in orbit, permanent orbit, down through another layer farther down, which are like our clouds, but moving fast. There's another area, liquid like water. Looks like it's got icebergs in it, but they're not icebergs. The atmosphere of Jupiter is very thick. I mean, this is what appears to be a hydrogen mantle about 100,000 miles off the surface." And then he goes into a description of crystals and creates a drawing of what he's seeing. But a lot of these descriptions that he came up with were matched by Sherman, who was in Arkansas, and then validated by Pioneer 10 in 1973 and Voyager 1 in 1979. And also the Juno satellite in 2000. So not only does Jupiter have rings, as he saw, but the dense swirling clouds surrounding the planet, the crazy storms he saw, and the floating crystals are also a thing, and they really exist. So Swan also made sketches of his Jupiter reviewing, which we can post on our Instagram. And this was not his only space voyage. He went to Mars. Since you already did a Mars trip, I'll spare everybody that. But in 1974, he and Sherman visited Mercury. And again, a lot of what they saw was validated later. So some of what Swan saw was that Mercury has a very thin atmosphere, which later was determined that it does. He saw rock formations of solid iron and like what he called metallic wastelands. And Mercury indeed has a lot of iron. He saw what he called a magnetosphere. And because of an iron core, Mercury has a magnetic field around it. Other things that he saw were a pockmarked surface with a lot of scarring, and Mercury has a lot of craters. And then also, despite it being so close to the sun and reaching temperatures as hot as 800 degrees Fahrenheit, Swan said that he was conscious of, quote, very cold temperatures in places that were away from the sun. And in 2008, the Messenger probe detected water ice on its surface in the shaded portions of some of the polar craters where the sun doesn't reach. So that was also validated. Wow. And then this is where it gets kind of weird. Swan also said that there must be something like lichen, sort of like a water-like life that attaches itself to rocks and goes through its life cycle that way. And then according to an article reporting that messenger findings on space.com, according to NASA, a mysterious dark organic matter covers some of the ice, leaving scientists puzzled.
Huh.
So that's on space.com.
Wow.
So also, Swan did visit Mars. And then in 1975, he was supposedly asked by government officials who learned about his other space travels. and they wanted him to perform this top secret viewing of the dark side of the moon, which revealed a lot of super crazy stuff. But I think we can talk about that in another episode because it really needs it. Not very shockingly, Swan was a believer in ufology, and he had some personal experiences of his own, which he later shared in his autobiography that was published in 1998, and it was called Penetration, The question of extraterrestrial and human telepathy.
Wait, so did he come across any life, any like intelligent life, I should say, or evidence of it in these travels?
Well, I can't, perhaps in the moon. It doesn't seem so necessarily in the Mars or the Mercury.
Okay.
Visit.
Yep.
But he did on Earth. He basically said that, he had encountered what he thought was an extraterrestrial in a supermarket in 1976 in Los Angeles.
Wow. Okay.
But she was like super sexy. He said she was notable not so much for her excessive female physical endowments, but by the fact that they were barely covered. She was dressed in the briefest of halters of pink with big yellow polka dots. Beneath that were short shorts, so short they barely existed. Far beneath that, she wore a pair of platform high heels about 8 inches high. She had volumes of gorgeous black hair, and her eyes were covered by purple sunglasses. And Swan felt that he knew that she was an extraterrestrial when he got close to her. And then he said he felt this, like, electrifying wave of goosebumps throughout his whole body. Okay.
Wow.
So basically, he believed that extraterrestrials are living on Earth in humanoid bodies, obviously, and they're apparently very sexy. And he also deduced that there are many of them, and many of them are bioandroids. I think that's his phrasing.
Bioandroids.
And that there are, and they're aware that on Earth their only foes are the psychics. So, psychics can see who they are.
right. Or Billy Corgan.
Right.
Remember the Billy Corgan story?
So, Ingo Swann passed away in 2013, and he was possibly the world's, first. But, I don't know. Maybe your guy was the first psychic astronaut.
Well, I mean, if we want to look at it, from a different point of view, I mean, Swedenborg, that whole Swedenborg story that I did was really about that. That's what it was about, right?
Yeah.
It was definitely done in different terms, but that's what he was suggesting, is that he sort of, somehow saw the worlds. But it was so less about the materiality of the worlds than the beings that sort of existed there. But
yeah. So just to offer a skeptical point of view,
the
Jupiter reports from Swan and Sherman were actually sent to Carl Sagan after Pioneer's data came back. So Sagan dismissed it in 1975 in a letter that he wrote as, quote, sixth grade science. And the word dreadful was used by him in the letter. But you got to remember, this was written in 1975, and this was years before the additional probes confirmed more information, and most crucially, the rings. Okay.
Right.
So I have one more story.
Okay.
And this is how remote viewing solved a crime.
Okay. I want to circle back to this, but let's do the crime
one bit. Okay. Okay, we'll do the crime one, and then we can circle back. Okay. Because I want to give the tip. Okay.
Okay, yes, tip.
All right. Okay. In 2006, a Las Vegas-based man named Robert Knight had grown concerned when he hadn't heard from one of his childhood friends in over a month. So Knight was a photographer who specialized in shooting concerts and rock and roll bands, and his close friend, Stephen B. Williams, was a DJ who lived in the Denver area. So naturally, Knight began asking people close to him and in their immediate circle if they'd seen or heard from Williams, but no one had. So he was growing more and more concerned. But next, Knight took an unconventional approach to trying to locate his friend. He'd been a believer in the paranormal since he was a teenager, when he reportedly saw a UFO rising out of the water on a Hawaiian beach. So he was down with all this stuff and thought that, it could help. So he approached Angela Thompson Smith, who had founded the Nevada Remote Viewing Group, and worked on the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Team and was also the research coordinator for the Bigelow Foundation, which, quote, engaged in paranormal research for its founder, Robert T. Bigelow, owner of Budget Suites of America chain and right. founder of Bigelow Aerospace. So the next time you stay at a Budget Suites, remember this. So Smith was a bona fide expert in remote viewing, and she agreed to help. And she assembled a team around her. It was like a 6-person team of fellow remote viewers. There was a retired airline captain, a former Air Force nurse, a civil engineer, a librarian, a photographer, and a civilian Air Force contractor. So it was kind of a motley crew of people. But they were all skilled in remote viewing. So each member of the team was given a coordinate to focus on. And basically, that was a random assortment of numbers and letters. It was supposed to help them focus their minds, I guess. I mean, obviously, they don't know where the guy is, so it's not that related to that. But then they got to work on remote viewing sessions that lasted anywhere from an hour to 3 hours. And the group came back with an answer. They had visualized a body caught in what looked like some crisscross netting in the waters near Catalina Island, which is off the coast of California. So understandably, Knight didn't want to believe this was true. But the evening after he got their report, he was in California on a photo shoot, and he was watching the news in his hotel room with his wife. And there was a story about the body of an unidentified man that was found off the coast of Catalina Island. And he knew, his heart sank, and he knew immediately this was his friend. The remote viewers had made a hit. So he called the county morgue at this point, and he told the woman who answered that he knew who the body was. And the morgue probably fields a lot of these calls. And so she asked him skeptically, "Oh, you do? How would you know that?" And at this point, Knight told her that the body would be missing 3 fingers off its left hand, which was the result of a shop class incident in 9th grade that had occurred nearly 50 years earlier. So the woman put him on hold and returned later to tell him that indeed the body was missing 3 fingers on the left hand. It was Williams. So if it weren't for the efforts of these remote viewers, his body may not have been identified. But the story isn't over yet, and there was foul play. So it turns out that William's death wasn't an accident. He had actually been murdered. So Knight told police, who came to talk to him later, that a man named Harvey Morrow had befriended Williams, and he claimed to be an investment advisor and had invested a few million dollars on Williams' behalf. So Williams is obviously pretty successful. So when police investigators looked into it, they found that Morrow had actually been stealing Williams' money, and furthermore, he was nowhere to be found. So again, the remote viewers went to work, and they came back and they told Knight that they had visualized Morrow traveling to the British Virgin Islands. And one of them had sketched a boat with Morrow on board. So they had a definite target that they maybe hit. But these reports were later shown to be accurate. So Morrow had indeed, he'd gone to the Caribbean. But then he later returned to the States, accepted a job as a car salesman in Montana, but his new boss turned out to be a former cop. So he Googled Morrow when he started his new job, I guess, and seeing that he was sought for questioning in Williams' murder, he turned him in. And then Morrow was arrested, convicted, and he's now serving a life sentence without parole for murder.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That's cool. Yeah, I kind of want to go into
that
whole...
crazy?
It is crazy. Because I feel like I've heard mixed things about, you know, psychics being used in police investigations. And, like, there's definitely, like, camps there where it's, like, some people are like, oh, no, they're all phonies. And then there's other camps that are like, no, it's real. And then they have been known to help. And then, so, I'd love to go into that some more.
Right. Like, I mean, I think if you look at, like...
I don't...
the descriptions of like what happened in these experiments and just like it just kind of makes sense to me. Like I feel like paying somebody by the minute to be able to like give you psychic readings doesn't make sense to me. I feel like it's something that is like it's not going to be 100%. And people are, I think there's a spectrum of like in varying degrees, people are tuned in and able to access whatever this is, you know?
Yeah, I mean,
it's not 100%, but there's something going on there.
There's something going on there. And I also don't necessarily like think that remote seeing is a necessary extension of you know, quote, psychic abilities, right? Like I concur with the CIA's assessment that it is an innate ability,
yeah,
sort of in everyone, right? And it's, you know, what you would call psychic abilities too, but, you know, just this ability to, and maybe there is a difference between it and astral projection. Like maybe some of the cases where we, you know, talk about astral projection, we're actually talking about remote seeing and vice versa. Because, I mean, I think there is a difference between having like an image, seeing an image, and what I would sort of describe as astral projection, which is like you're literally like leaving your body, right? You're having an out-of-body experience.
Yeah. I mean, this seems clearly, to be like not that in a lot of cases. It's like people...
Right. It's not that. Like, it's not like that. It's something else. Something. So maybe it is.
Yeah. I mean, often for what it's worth, Russell Targ, who was one of the, you know, people involved in the original experiments, he was a physicist, and I saw a talk with him, and he said that like what he called non-locality, it's not parapsychology or New Age. He said it's an innate skill that all of us have and can learn. And he said that he always tells people, just close your eyes, quiet your mind, and describe the surprising pictures that appear in your awareness. Don't try and name it. Don't try and guess. Just describe the surprising images. So that's his advice. That's his tip.
That's the tip for remote
viewing. Remote viewing.
So it's like you're like, can you go over it again? So you're like, you're sitting quietly somewhere in bed.
Quiet your mind.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
Quiet your mind.
And then describe
eyes closed.
The surprising images that appear.
So images are just sort of coming.
Don't try and name it. So like, don't try and pin it down. Don't try and like analyze it. I feel like there's something in the analysis. And I know this from like, just like being a writer, like, the moment that you try and edit yourself and censor yourself and criticize and you get that like analysis going, you can kill that inspiration. And maybe the same thing's going on with this. So it's like, just like first thought, best thought, just, you know, going with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. So what do you think? I mean, what do you think so in terms of the like traveling around to other planets and stuff, like what do you think is happening there? Like what do you think this
oh man, I really want to believe in it. I mean, it's pretty compelling. I mean, some of the things, I mean, for people who were not astrophysicists, coming up with descriptions of these distant planets and describing their makeup in ways that later were confirmed to be accurate. I mean, obviously they had contact with scientists. Had they heard discussion by these people? And but it seems like it was kind of removed. It wasn't like, I don't know if there were any specialists from NASA involved. I don't know.
I mean
I think it's totally
that
legit.
Earth.
Yeah, I mean, if you could do it, it seems like there wouldn't be any kind of barrier to it. And another thing that's interesting that I saw that Russell Targ mentioned in a talk was that when he was talking about some of the Stargate experiments, he said that one of the subjects, and I don't remember who it was visualizing something, and it was some kind of a base or whatever, the target, but they drew a picture of it, and they drew a picture of water towers, which didn't exist then. But then years later, it came out that actually, decades prior, there actually had been water towers at that site. So the person was visualizing not only the site that they were given geographically, but also we're seeing back in time.
That's the coolest part of all these stars to me, is the like the time aspect, where it's like you're seeing back, you know, and certainly there's sort of accounts of that with psychics where they touch something and they, you know, sense a sort of history about it. But but this guy that's like given this envelope with, you know, it says 1 million years on it, and he doesn't even know that that's the case, and the monitor sort of getting him to go back even farther. He's like, okay, but back before the storms and all this, and that I thought was fascinating. Just the notion that he was potentially seeing something that happened on Mars a million years ago. That there was this.
What do you think?
Race or about that guy in particular, or about like just in general the.
In
subject?
General.
Yeah, I mean.
Both.
So like I said, like, I don't know what the whole psychic thing really means without like really getting into that subject. But like remote seeing, yeah, I think there's definitely, evidence for it. Right. And I do believe in astral projection. I do believe in the sort of spiritual experience that people have where they've traveled to other dimensions or other, you know, places in the universe. So I think it's, you know, just in the most fundamental level, it's definitely possible for the consciousness to be separate from the body, right? We got into that with the near-death experience, right? Like if you can experience your consciousness after death, right? Like why couldn't it, you know, travel even farther? So, and you know, through time, right? Like, so I think there's certainly something to it. And I think it's definitely something that is in all of us. Like, I believe that these are all abilities. I don't think somebody could have an ability that other people can't have. Do you know what I mean? They might have it better, but you know what I mean? It's not like there's like people out there with like wings or like, I don't know, with like two heads and well, sometimes, but you know, like there's not like human beings that have other stuff unless it's some sort of mutation, right? That others don't. And so I think that we all have these abilities. I think our psychic life is much richer than we sort of give ourselves credit for. And I think the possibilities are, you know, this is like, you know, if we really like understood the possibilities of the mind, like this stuff would seem like small fries.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my thoughts.
Awesome.
And I want to learn how to do it. I want to.
Me too. I want to go to Mars.
I want to go see where they shot it. My favorite line from it, I forget what he said. It was something like, go back to the ones before the storms or something. That sounded like a line from like Dune or something. Cool. Well, this was fun. Like this, I felt like this was a surprisingly, it went in directions that I didn't know it was going to go in. You know, I thought it was going to be about like finding submarines and, you know.
Yeah, me too. I'm like, oh, he's totally doing military stuff. We both.
Yeah,
space.
Yeah, yeah. So this was cool.
Explorations.
And I want to get into the whole like, police and psychic relationship. I think that would be a cool thing to explore, right?
It really would, yeah. It really would.
Anyways. But yeah, I like the synchronicity that we both had psychic astronaut stories. So that's cool.
Awesome.
All right. Well, I feel like we did it, yeah?
Yeah, we did it. Cool.
Remote viewing, yeah. Cool. So I guess until next time.
All right. I'll talk to you later.
Talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.
Shadowland Podcast is produced by Seth Javelin and Christina Callery. Edited by Tim Kelly. Theme music by Tim Lincoln.
Thanks, Tim.